This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This week, we're looking at Milwaukee's status as the most segregated metropolitan area in the country in our latest Project Milwaukee series, Segregation Matters. Friday on the show, we spoke with Reggie Jackson, producer of a series of presentations on the history of segregation here. You can listen back to that interview on our website.
But how do we even quantify the state of segregation here? And even if we know people of different ethnicities live in different neighborhoods, how do we know that separation comes with negative consequences? Mark Levine has broken down much of the data to paint a comprehensive picture of what segregation looks like in Milwaukee.
Levine is a professor and the director of the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. We reached him by phone in Maryland. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. It's always a pleasure.
So one of the popular narratives when it comes to segregation in Milwaukee is the idea that there are different ways of reading the situation, that it is not as cut and dried as its reputation. Where does what you have found in your research fit into that question?
Probably falls a little bit in the middle. I mean, on the one part, it is a cut-and-dried situation. I think when we say it's not cut-and-dried, that seems to leave the implication that, well, maybe we're not as segregated as people think. And that simply isn't true. We are among the most segregated metropolitan areas in the country. I mean, maybe there's some debate about the most segregated. I'm not sure that's an interesting question. I think the bigger question is, what are the group that are the most segregated and what are the causes kind of that segregation? And you'd have to be an ostrich with a head buried in the sand to be missing the fact that Milwaukee is among the four or five most segregated metropolitan areas in the country by any measure that social scientists use, and has been so for 40 years. Ranking hasn't changed. Where I think the issue of not so cut and dried comes in is on connecting the issue of segregation to other indicators. That is to say, linked to levels of inequality, levels of racial disparity. Segregation is inherently connected to those things, but sometimes we think of sort of segregation as simply just the separation of groups that may choose to live in different residential areas, and that's not quite as pernicious as obviously the deeper inequality that flow from what we think of as segregation. So I'm comfortable with people saying we need to have more nuance in how we talk about segregation, but I don't think anyone should be misled by saying, well, it's not as cut and dried as saying Milwaukee is the most segregated metropolitan area in the country, to then sort of almost slide from that to think that segregation isn't as serious here as it really is.
Right. So how do we quantify it then? I mean, what does it look like in Milwaukee beyond just African-Americans living in this part of town, Latinos living in this part of town, and whites living in this part of town?
Right. Well, that's the first measure you start off with, obviously, concentration of groups in various parts of the metropolitan area. And we have various ways of measuring that, but they all point in the same direction. And Milwaukee, as I said, is among the four or five metropolitan areas with the greatest concentration of groups in separate areas. That's just sort of just a simple baseline way, demographic way of measuring the distribution of groups. But to me, and this is where my research, I think, hopefully makes a bit of a contribution, is to connect that to the other indicators of sort of racial disparities that attach to those geographic differences. To me, the most profound one is the question of concentrated poverty. To what extent is a particular racial group living disproportionately in areas of what we call concentrated poverty, which sociologists define as neighborhoods, either by census tract or zip code, that have at least 40% of the residents living below the poverty line. The overlap, the correlation, if you will, is very strong between the level of segregation in any metropolitan area and the level of concentrated poverty. And so Milwaukee ranks among the highest in segregation by these various indicators that I mentioned earlier, and we rank second to Detroit in the percentage of African Americans in the region living in concentrated poverty neighborhoods. About a third of Metro Milwaukee's black population lives in neighborhoods in which 40% or more of the population is poor, and that's a third of the entire black population, so that includes some relatively affluent, certainly middle-class black households that are actually living in not only relatively poor neighborhoods, but concentrated poverty neighborhoods. And to me, that's a profound indicator of the extent and the tightness and maybe the entrenched nature of segregation in the community.
Right. So, and let's talk about that, because that is a glaring statistic as we dig into the numbers, that there are a large number of African Americans, and I gather Latinos to some degree, who have presumably the income to live in other neighborhoods, yet still live in high poverty segregated neighborhoods. What do we know about the relative frequency of that phenomenon, and why?
The numbers is, I think, incredibly striking, more so than any metropolitan area in the country. If we take a relatively affluent black household, and as you point out, it's the same for Latinos as well in Milwaukee, a black household with income over $100,000 a year, and we compare that just in Milwaukee to a white household with income over $100,000 a year, the black household with income over $100,000 a year is 35 times more likely to live in a concentrated poverty neighborhood. About 1/6, about 15% of black households in Milwaukee making over $100,000 a year live in a concentrated poverty neighborhood. If we take black households making over $200,000, it's a very small number in Milwaukee, so the error margin is fairly high on this, but I put it out just to be suggestive. Almost a little over, I should say, 20%, 1 in 5 of those households, actually a higher percentage than the 100,000, but that may be, you know, part of the error issue. But let's just, you know, be simple here and say 1 in 5 households making over $200,000 a year among black households in Milwaukee live in concentrated poverty neighborhoods. That's much higher, obviously, than white households, similarly affluent in Milwaukee, and it's much higher than black affluent households anywhere in the country. I mean, for example, 15% of Milwaukee's over $100,000 a year black households live in concentrated poverty neighborhoods. Less than 1% of Atlanta's and Baltimore's live in such neighborhoods. So we're talking not only about black-white disparities here, but we're talking about disparities between black affluent Milwaukee and middle class and black affluent middle class in other metropolitan areas. And then one final sort of, I think, striking indicator along these lines is if you compare a black household in Milwaukee making $100,000 a year to white households making under $10,000 a year, a black household has about 1.2, 1.3 times greater a chance of living in the concentrated poverty neighborhood. About 15% of Milwaukee's over $100,000 a year black households live in concentrated poverty neighborhoods. About 9% of Milwaukee's under white households with an income under $10,000 live in such neighborhoods. So, you know, basically, income of over $100,000 a year for a black household buys you in Milwaukee a somewhat poorer neighborhood than for a white household with income around $10,000 a year. That's an extraordinary disparity. In my mind, and it reflects again to me the pervasiveness and the entrenched nature of segregation in the community. Now, you ask, what are the reasons? You know, we don't know for sure all of the reasons, and why is Milwaukee so different than so many other metro areas along this one indicator? We do know, obviously, that Milwaukee ranks very high in terms of disparities in lending, so there may be an issue in terms of bank practices, in terms of the ability to get mortgages in suburban areas.
Right. Where does suburbanization come into this?
Right. And that's the second point, is that, you know, we have the lowest level of black suburbanization in the country. Is that a matter of discrimination in housing in the suburbs, even for the affluent households, let alone, you know, the long talked about issue of the lack of affordable housing in suburbs, so you're not going to get lower income black households having access to housing in the suburbs? Is it a matter of a kind of a culture in the suburbs that is perceived to be unwelcoming to the black community? So in some ways, there is a choice, and I put that in quotation marks, that sort of made saying we're not going to move to the suburbs except for maybe a few in a sliver of inner suburbs like Brown Deer and Glendale, but certainly not out into Washington or Ozaukee or Waukesha County. It's unclear which of those factors is the most important, but one would have to suspect that, you know, lending practices and patterns of real estate steering and the like probably play a role here, maybe even to a greater extent. I mean, it exists nationally, obviously, but maybe to a greater extent than in other places. I mean, I think this is something that's going to require a lot more research. What I've done is, I think, just sort of lay out the quantitative indicators that point us in the direction. But I think, you know, folks on the ground, people in the fair housing area, you know, are really I think, going to want to really, and they have been to some extent, you know, dig into this issue.
Well, and presumably these things are not mutually exclusive. It could be lending practices and a sense of, you know, feeling welcome or unwelcome and, you know, five or six of these other factors as well.
Yes, yes. These things all tend to reinforce one another. They become mutually reinforcing. It's kind of the issue of, you know, why does segregation persist? Well, we know there are historical patterns. We know there are policies in the past that created a pattern of segregation, redlining practices, restrictive covenants, zoning, I mean, de jure segregation, de jure discrimination that is now no longer legal, but those past practices still have an effect on residential patterns and labor markets and housing markets, whole bunches of issues over time. There is, of course, then still persistent discrimination. We know that, obviously, from the work we've done on labor markets. We know that, obviously, from the real estate data that's been published over the years. And then there's, you know, de facto segregation, as you say, the matter of choice, or de facto in the sense that, you know, so because of the rampant economic inequalities in Milwaukee, the median black household income is less than 50%. It's actually 45% of the white household income that a large chunk of the African-American community can't afford to purchase housing in the suburbs, so that becomes de facto. But as one wise person once said, there's really no such thing as truly de facto discrimination or truly de facto segregation. Those de facto inequalities all have a root in past practices that were definitely part of explicit segregationist and discriminatory policies in the community.
Well, so do you have data that shows how this has changed over time? I mean, and can you overlay how segregation has changed along with the levels of poverty, if you will?
Yeah, we've obviously got the segregation indicators for forever, but certainly, you know, back over the last 40 or 50 years that, you know, we look at the data on this. And if we just look at black-white segregation in Milwaukee, it's stayed basically constant over the last 40 years. There's been a slight decline in the index of dissimilarity, which is sort of the standard measure that we use, but not a great deal. And that does differ, actually, from a lot of other metropolitan areas. I think the social scientists who wrote the study, I think two or three years ago, looking at segregation levels over the last 40 years remarked on the decline in black-white segregation in many metro areas, and I think prematurely proclaimed the end of the segregated century, meaning the 20th century as we're now into the 21st century, but they rather conspicuously left Milwaukee out of that, saying, you know, black-white segregation really hadn't declined much. So that's remained relatively constant, and as that has remained relatively constant, as blacks have remained concentrated in essentially inner central city area, not into the suburbs, obviously, of Milwaukee, inner city area where the economy has deteriorated over the last 40 years, where jobs have moved out, to where a spatial mismatch between jobs in the suburbs and the unemployed in central city areas has grown, where non-employment has skyrocketed, where over 50% of working age African-American males are not employed in those central city neighborhoods. You've seen a growth in the kind of distress that is associated, for example, with concentrated poverty. You see the development of broad swaths of cumulative disadvantage, as some social scientists have referred to it. And so consequently, this has evolved. The worst decade, quite frankly, was in the 1980s in Milwaukee, where the drop-off in the industrial economy, the loss of manufacturing jobs, profoundly injured the economic base of the black community. And so that's where you saw the skyrocketing of black joblessness and black poverty. And so that by 1990, Milwaukee was like far in a way, on top, if that's the right way to put it, in the worst position, having the highest levels, highest percentage of blacks living in concentrated poverty, 46%. So that's come down a bit. The 1990s were actually a relatively helpful decade in that regard. There was some economic growth, and now it's, you know, begun to sort of come back up a little bit, particularly the recession hurt a great deal, so we're back around 33%. So over time, it's grown. But just to give you a sense of the change in this, in 1970, there were 6 census tracts in the city of Milwaukee in which 40% of the population lived in concentrated poverty. Today there are 61, right? So it's a big change, and those 61 are predominantly African American and Latino.
Well, and so maybe to completely oversimplify things, if it weren't for this poverty overlay, would we even be having this conversation? As it happens, we're talking to you. You're in Baltimore right now, and there are neighborhoods that are predominantly African American, and there are neighborhoods that are predominantly white. But the conversation isn't the same when you talk about Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it is, in the sense that obviously you've got problems of poverty, although the black poverty level here is lower than it is in Milwaukee. You've obviously got high levels of black joblessness, again, lower than it is in Milwaukee. And you certainly have, you know, distressed conditions that exploded in 2015 with the Freddie Gray uprising in East and West Baltimore, primarily West Baltimore. So, you know, the conditions in Upton and Sandtown, Winchester here in Baltimore are certainly comparable to Milwaukee 53206 or some of our worst neighborhoods. The difference, though, the reason that you don't have as intense concentrated poverty in Baltimore, in other words, not as high a percentage of the black population in total, and certainly nowhere near the percentage of the black middle class or affluent living in concentrated poverty in Baltimore, is that you have a pretty substantial black suburbanization here. Over 30% of Baltimore, of the metro area's black population, lives in the suburbs. Lots of black middle class jobs were created in Baltimore in the 1970s and 80s, particularly public sector employment, government employment. There are obviously some federal government buildings in Baltimore and a number of other sort of government jobs that have gone to African Americans in Baltimore. And so, you know, that deconcentration of poverty, that suburbanization has, I think, made a bit of a difference. And I think it does point us, at least in some direction in Milwaukee, of the need to, I think, simultaneously, and I hope this doesn't sound contradictory, deconcentrate poverty, open up the suburbs, obviously have fair housing, affordable housing, transportation, you know, everything attached to having a more knit-together and egalitarian region. And at the same time you open up the suburbs and deconcentrate poverty, you also have a regional policy that targets resources to the most distressed areas of cities and creates incentives for businesses to locate in central city areas. But yeah, at a certain level, we wouldn't have the same kind of conversation if the economic inequalities were not so attached to these sort of issues of demographic concentration. I mean, we don't worry too much about predominantly black suburbs in Atlanta, in which the median, or Washington, D.C., for that matter, in which the median household income is well over $100,000 a year, and the poverty rate is very low. That presumably is some matter of choice, and it's not a matter of overt discrimination, and it's certainly not a matter of pervasive inequality. So the conversation changes when these demographic patterns are connected to socioeconomic disparities and inequality.
So, you know, as you look at this, it sounds like if you were to offer some thoughts as to where to start unraveling this, the single first domino sounds like the opening up of the suburbs.
I think that's clearly a part of this. You know, obviously, there's a big debate among sociologists about programs in housing vouchers to enable folks to, it's called move to opportunity programs. There's sort of mixed data on it, but some of the more recent studies suggest that that does lead to economic improvements for families. I mean, I would take it a step further and say, and I'm hopeful that your series will contribute to this, a placing again at the top of our community agenda, the issue of segregation and figuring out how a whole packet of policies can be used to mitigate and decrease segregation in the community. So it's not only, you know, sort of starting with housing and obviously some of the economic development issues that I talked about earlier, but you know, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about schools, since Milwaukee has, not unsurprisingly, given the other indicators, the highest level of black-white school segregation in the country. Over 70% of black K-12 students in Metro Milwaukee attend what education scholars call hyper-segregated schools, in which 90% or more of the students in the school are minority students. And that's about the same as it was in 1965, when there was a study done on this by the Civil Rights Commission. It declined over the years. We had the 220 program, we had the desegregation order in the city of Milwaukee, and it dipped down to around 20% of black students attending hyper-segregated schools by the early 1990s, and now we've resegregated. All the research shows that the highest correlation, I mean, we talk about the achievement gap, and we have advocates, I would say many of whom are quite ideological, on issues of school choice and vouchers, saying, you know, we need to close the achievement gap, and the only way we can do that is through essentially the privatization of our schools. But we know from research that the highest correlate by far on academic achievement is the issue is school segregation. That if you desegregate schools, if you lower the segregation level of schools, you're likely to see a closing of the achievement gap, particularly if that desegregation is of a socioeconomic nature, so that you don't have a concentration not only of a racial group but of poverty in those schools. So I think, you know, we should recommit ourselves as a region to the notion of desegregation across a whole range of policies. And controversial though it may be, we know it's a conflictual issue. It has been historically. The desegregation of schools should move to the top of our agenda in education policy instead of some of the battles that we're having over issues of choice and vouchers.
Mark Levine, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
Mark Levine is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. You can read more about his research into the data that helps define segregation in the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com.